Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How well have you studied the Bible? Countless people have read and treasured it as a sacred document over the years, but far fewer have undertaken the kind of critical and historical study of the Bible required of most seminary students. And while many people of faith are content with using the Bible only as a devotional instrument, my guest today believes limiting Bible study to divining its messages means missing out on a full understanding of what they hold sacred. Bart Ehrman is James A. Gray Distinguished Professor of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. His latest book is called Jesus Interrupted, Revealing the Hidden Contradictions in the Bible and Why We Don't Know About Them. Bart, welcome back to Think.
Thanks for having me.
What do we gain from looking at the Bible the way historians might?
One of the problems that people have reading the Bible is that they simply assume that everything in the Bible, every author of the Bible, is agreeing with every other author of the Bible. And I think one of the things that a historical reading does is it shows you that there is a wide range of view in the Bible. There are different perspectives, different opinions, different theologies, so that each author of the Bible has to be taken for what he has to say rather than assuming that he's saying what somebody else is also saying in the Bible. And so I think a historical reading provides a lot more kind of breadth and depth for understanding the Bible.
And you point out in the book that the vast majority of Christian pastors, including many evangelicals, are in fact required in seminary to look at the Bible this way.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing in seminaries and divinity schools, in all the mainline schools, Presbyterian, Methodist, Lutheran, Episcopalian. Students are taught the historical method, which looks at these books in their own historical context rather than simply assuming that they are sort of handed down from on high. And for a lot of students, it's a shock to the system to see how scholars have studied the Bible over the centuries. What's even more surprising maybe is that what students learn in their Bible classes in seminary doesn't get passed on to their congregations. So that most of the time, the person on the street or the person in the pew has never actually even heard what scholars are saying about the Bible.
Why do you think that doesn't filter down to what they have to say every Sunday or Wednesday?
Well, I think there are two reasons that most people have never heard what scholars have to say about the Bible. One is that scholars themselves are terrible at communicating to normal human beings. And the other reason is that pastors, for some reason, decide not to tell their congregations. I completely agree with people who think that a weekly sermon is not the place to talk about the scholarship on the Bible, but churches do have adult education classes, and I think it's a pity that more adults aren't getting educated in what the pastors themselves have learned.
One of the omissions that you think many people make in trying to thoroughly study the Bible is the tendency to read it vertically, meaning straight through the book, one page after another. What happens when we go through the Gospels simultaneously and then compare the events that they describe?
That's right. People who do read the Bible, which is no longer the majority of people, but the people who do tend to read it from top to bottom, from the beginning verse to the end verse. But when you read it differently, when you read it horizontally, you get a different point of view. In other words, when you read Matthew, you read a story in Matthew, then read the same story in Mark and the same story in Luke, you realize that there are many differences between these Gospels, and sometimes these differences are out-and-out discrepancies, contradictions. These contradictions are important not simply to show that, in fact, somebody's making mistakes, but also they're important because they show that each of these authors actually has a different perspective and that they're not all saying the same thing. And that if you allied the various books and pretend they're all saying the same thing, in effect, what you've done is you've created your own gospel, which is unlike any of those in the New Testament.
Now, of course, there are a lot of people who say what they're doing is not pretending that they say the same thing. They are trying to sort of unravel the mystery that God has put into the Bible and find a way to explain what appears to human audiences to be inaccuracies or discrepancies.
I think that's right, and people certainly do that. But there, I think when you look at the Bible historically, from a historical point of view, that there are some discrepancies that simply cannot be reconciled. They in fact are different. I mean, just as a simple example, a very basic, simple example. In Mark's gospel, Jesus dies the day before the Passover meal was eaten. Mark is very clear in dating this event. In the gospel of John, In Mark's gospel, he dies the day after the Passover meal is eaten, and Mark explicitly says that. And John also explicitly dates when Jesus dies, and he says that Jesus died the day before the Passover meal was eaten. So they both are trying to make a point by what they have to say about when Jesus died, but historically, it's impossible to reconcile the two because Jesus didn't die twice on two different days. He died only once. So one of them has gotten it wrong historically, or else they both gotten it wrong, but they both can't be right.
Another thing that's notable, the death accounts are different, and the birth accounts of Jesus are strikingly different from one book to the next. Can you talk about both the Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of Luke put Jesus in Bethlehem at the time of his arrival in the world, but have very different reasons why that happened?
Though they certainly do, and this is another thing people have never noticed, because every Christmas people talk about the Christmas story, and what they've done is they've taken the stories from Matthew and the stories from Luke and combined them together into one large story. But when you actually just read what Matthew has to say and make a list of everything that happens, and then read what Luke has to say and make a list of everything that happens, it turns out that virtually all the stories in Matthew are found only in Matthew, and all the stories found in Luke are found only in Luke. And so they're different from each other. But for example, Matthew has the wise men coming to Jesus, and Luke has the shepherds coming to worship Jesus. Well, that's just a difference. That's not really a discrepancy. But when you look at some of the differences, they're impossible to reconcile with one another. And so the Christmas pageant that people celebrate every Christmas, in fact, smooths over the differences in such a way that the message that Matthew's trying to convey doesn't get conveyed, and the message that Luke is trying to convey doesn't get conveyed.
One thing that they were both trying to convey was that Jesus was born in Bethlehem, which
Yes.
was fulfillment of a prophecy that was well known from the Old Testament.
That's right. Both of them have Jesus born in Bethlehem, and in both of them his mother is a virgin. What is striking is that they get Jesus born in Bethlehem in different ways. In Matthew's gospel, if you had no knowledge of anything but Matthew's gospel, it would be very clear that Joseph and Mary are from Bethlehem. This is where they live. The wise men come to Jesus when he's in a house. Joseph and Mary's house, and they come many months, maybe up to 2 years after Jesus is born. And so this is where Joseph and Mary live, so that when they escape to Egypt to avoid the wrath of King Herod, they want to return to Bethlehem, but they can't because Herod's son Archelaus is the ruler now, and he's worse than his father. And so they can't go back to Bethlehem. They have to go to Nazareth. And so Jesus is raised in Nazareth, even though he's born in Bethlehem, according to Matthew. According to Luke, you get a similar thing. Jesus is raised in Nazareth, but he's born in Bethlehem. But here you have a completely different story. In this story, Joseph and Mary live in Nazareth, but they have this tax that they have to register for. And so with everybody else in the Roman Empire, they return to their ancestral home, which happens to be Bethlehem, because Joseph is from the line of King David, who was born in Bethlehem. So they go to Bethlehem to register for the census, and it turns out while they're there, it just happens that Mary gives birth then, and so Jesus is born in Bethlehem, even though he's from Nazareth. And then a month later, they return to Nazareth. So in Luke's account, there's no time for them to flee to Egypt the way they do in Matthew, because Luke doesn't know anything about a flight to Egypt or about the wise men or any of the stories found in Matthew.
So a historian would go and look at other contemporary records of the day and find out which is perhaps closer to the events that are mentioned by each of these gospel writers.
That's right. And, you know, when you do that, neither one of them comes up very well, as it turns out. And just to take Luke, for example, Luke says that there was this worldwide census under Caesar Augustus. Well, we have a lot of records from the time of Caesar Augustus, and there's no mention anywhere of a worldwide census. And when you think about it, it's a little bit hard to believe, because Joseph goes to Bethlehem because his ancestor David was from there. Well, David lived 1,000 years before Joseph. So everybody's going to their ancestral home from when their ancestors came 1,000 years before. I mean, so I asked my students, I mean, suppose Baraka institutes a new tax and we all have to go to the home that our ancestors came from 1,000 years ago. You know, where would you go? And the idea that the whole empire is doing this and there's no mention of it in any historical record really defies imagination.
It is worth noting here that you were once an evangelical Christian yourself, and today you're an agnostic, but you take pains to point out that you did not lose your faith because of the kind of discrepancies in the Bible that you're talking about today.
That's right. I mean, I have a chapter in this book, Jesus Interrupted, that's called Is Faith Possible? And the reason I have this chapter is because some people, especially in my part of the country, in the American South, think that if you don't believe that the Bible is absolutely infallible, then you can't be a Christian. And I point out that that's simply not true historically. The views that I lay out in Jesus Interrupted are the views that I learned in a Christian seminary training to be a Christian minister. And they're the views taught in the majority of mainline Christian seminaries throughout the country, not to mention virtually all the universities in Europe and in North America. And many of the people teaching these things are themselves believing Christians. It's just that they have a different view of the Bible than the evangelical understanding that it's the infallible Word of God.
Is it a risk, though, particularly for people who do come from faith traditions that teach the complete inerrancy of the Bible, that anyone taught to look at it critically will then find it impossible to consider it sacred?
Yeah, well, that's always a possibility. And I talk about in the book about how I went from being an evangelical Christian to being a liberal Christian with a liberal view of the Bible, because I just didn't see how otherwise I could deal with it, because there are these discrepancies. And it's the sort of thing where nobody has to take my word for it or some other scholar's word for it. They can simply do this kind of horizontal reading themselves and see. I mean, simply take what all four Gospels say about the resurrection and compare them with one another, and there are irreconcilable differences. And so I think it does force somebody to have a different view of the Bible, but I don't think that necessarily leads to a loss of faith. Almost all of my close friends in the field, in New Testament studies, are personally Christian. Many of them work in seminaries and teach divinity students, but they agree with basically everything I say in the book. And so I don't think it needs to lead to a loss of faith at all.
Another thing that you write about that's very interesting is the reaction of your students when you call upon them, often for the first time, to do this sort of study. And they sort of fall into three different categories.
Yeah, that's right. So I teach in North Carolina. A lot of my students are from North Carolina. A lot of them have been raised in the church and are more committed to the Bible than knowledgeable about it. And so when I have them do these kinds of exercises where they compare Matthew and Luke's versions of Jesus' birth, for example, or the various accounts of Jesus' death or his resurrection, they see these discrepancies. And so some students don't want to hear it, and so it's as if they put their fingers in their ears and hum real loud, so they don't have to deal with these issues.
Let me stop you for a second. Can you relate to that? Was there a time when you felt the same way?
Absolutely. When I was an evangelical Christian in college, I never would have taken a class from someone like me. So I completely relate to that. There are other students who go the other extreme, who basically come away thinking, well, the Bible's full of contradictions, so I'm not going to believe anything anymore. So I don't think there are too many of that kind of student, but there are some. But I'd say the majority of my students are sort of in the middle, and they realize now that there's a different view from the one they were raised on, and it makes them more thoughtful and more intelligent about what it is they believe. And that's the reaction that I actually prefer. I mean, I'm not trying to make people agnostic. I'm just trying to teach what the Bible is all about from a historical perspective, and thinking that probably if somebody's a believer, it's better to be a knowledgeable believer than it is to be an ignorant believer.
Bart Ehrman is my guest. He is James A. Gray, Distinguished Professor of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. His newest book is called Jesus Interrupted, Revealing the Hidden Contradictions in the Bible and Why We Don't Know About Them. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Bart Ehrman is my guest this hour. He is James A. Gray, Distinguished Professor of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. His newest book is called Jesus Interrupted, Revealing the Hidden Contradictions in the Bible and Why We Don't Know About Them. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org. Bart, how closely do the texts that we study today as the Bible align with the oldest available iterations of the Bible?
Well, yeah, that's a great question because most people don't realize that we don't have the original copies of any of the books of the Bible, either Old Testament or New Testament. In what I talk about in Jesus Interrupted, just the New Testament, we don't have copies for we don't have complete copies of the entire New Testament for over 300 years after these books were written, or around 300 years. We start getting copies. Complete copies of one gospel or another, maybe about 120, 130 years after these books were written. So that we have some early copies, but the striking thing is that all of these copies that we have differ from one another, sometimes, a lot of times in very small ways, but sometimes in very big ways. And so one of the tasks of scholarship is trying to figure out what the originals said, given the fact that we don't have the originals or any accurate copies of the originals.
And one thing that you believe is that there are forgeries, and I'll put that word in quotes, that's your word, in the current iterations of the Bible, passages that were added to the original text perhaps years or even decades after they were first written.
Right. I think there are two things going on. There are some passages that were added to the Bible after it was originally written. So that, for example, this is not a controversial view among scholars. Scholars have known this for hundreds of years. But as an example, the famous story of Jesus and the woman taken in adultery, where Jesus says, "Let the one without sin among you be the first to cast a stone at her." It's a terrific story, but scholars have known for a very long time that it was not originally in the Gospels; that it was a story added later by scribes, because it's not in our earliest and best manuscripts. There are other books that would be technically actual forgeries. If by forgery you mean a writing that claims to be written by somebody who didn't actually write it, well, as it turns out, there are books like that in the New Testament. The vast majority of critical scholars would agree, for example, that the book of 2 Peter wasn't really written by Peter, and that several of the letters that claim to be written by Paul, such as 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus, were not actually written by Paul, but were written by later followers of Paul claiming to be Paul.
And you think that they weren't written by Paul based in part on the attitude and the positions that they take on certain issues?
That's part of it. With Paul, we're in a pretty good situation because there are seven letters that virtually everybody agrees Paul wrote. And so we can compare these questionable letters with the indisputable letters. And when you do that, there are enormous differences in vocabulary and in writing style, and even differences in theological points of view and views about how the church is to operate, so that it looks like these actually come from a different author.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Bart Ehrman is my guest. His newest book is called Jesus Interrupted. Let's go to Tim in Dallas. Hello, Tim.
Hey, boy, what a great subject. The guest made an assertion earlier of why scholarship taking place in adult religious education in churches might or might not be available, the reasons why. It's my personal opinion that scholarship and faith, they mix like oil and water. That's the main reason. Anyone knows that, you know, scholarship leads to questions, and in this case, the possibility that long-held and in some cases deeply indoctrinated beliefs might not be as rooted in the quote-unquote reality that deep objective research of the Bible and of religion in general might expose. So, in my opinion, it's fear. It's fear on the basis of the institutions, kind of like censorship in a totalitarian society. If you make it difficult to obtain the knowledge, you have a better chance of keeping the people blissfully ignorant.
Is it fear, Bart?
That may be true in some cases. And, you know, my view of it is that people really want to know, that people have a desire for knowledge, and that people obviously don't want to be ignorant. Whenever I go into churches to speak, I almost always will have somebody come up to me afterwards and say, "Why haven't I heard this before?" And it's often a mystery to me because the pastor of the church has gone to a good seminary and has learned the stuff in his Bible classes, but hasn't taught his congregation. And so it may be that in some cases it really is fear that's driving that.
How do those pastors then who go back to their churches and start, really dedicated lives, they must know for themselves that they went through a process by which they were able to reconcile these things?
That's right. And so I think that there's absolutely no reason not to inform the person in the pew, so to speak, what scholars have taught in seminaries, so that the pastors who learn this and have to deal with it themselves shouldn't be afraid of teaching their people this, because it's something they have to deal with. I think that knowledge, true knowledge, can't really endanger faith, and so people shouldn't be afraid of knowledge.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Rowlett and speak with Melissa. Hi, Melissa.
Hi. I was very excited to hear that Mr. Ehrman was coming on the show. So I, because this is a topic that comes up a lot. I'm a Christian, and definitely I've had friends who have brought up some of the topics he's talking about. But I thought it was funny when I was Googling his book that it came up as recommended on several Theosophist websites, which for those who aren't initiated, Theosophists are actually Satan worshipers. So make of that what you will. What I did want to address directly is that I recall from his appearance on Fresh Air that he took issue with what the four Gospels had to say about Jesus' crucifixion and how they reported that Jesus said different things. And so I took a deep breath, and I spent about 20 minutes going between the four Gospels, and I did find harmony among the Gospels, which would probably shock him. I mean, it says that Jesus cried out, for example, twice. So there were two instances when he cried out loudly, and he said two separate things, which might explain why one verse talks about him crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me, versus, you know, I commend my spirit to you. I mean, he says, my God, first, and then I commend my spirit to you on the second cry. And as far as him saying that, and I don't think he's disrespectful at all to God when he says, my God, why have you forsaken me, because that goes right back to Psalm 22, and he's quoting Psalm 22, which is indeed a psalm of praise to God. So I just really want people out in your audience who really do care about getting to know God to not to despair, not to take this guy seriously, but take a deep breath, read the Bible yourself. You're not going to find the inconsistencies that he's bringing up, because he's being very selective about the scriptures that he does present to you. And I also encourage you, if you have any issues about scientific beliefs and scholarship not agreeing with the Bible, to read a book called Unlocking the Mysteries of Creation by Dennis R. Peterson,
Melissa,
where he goes over different evidences and proof of why the Bible and creationism, for example, makes sense.
I do appreciate your call.
And I hope your show is canceled. I'm getting really tired of these shows.
I'm sorry that you're not happy about it.
The Bible.
Well, we did give you a chance to speak your piece, Melissa. Thank you for calling. Bart, I know that these are criticisms that you hear often. Can you address them sort of in a general way, and then maybe a more specific way in terms of the crucifixion?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what I used to believe before I started studying more. And I used to think that you could reconcile all of these accounts. But I would ask your caller, which day did Jesus die on? Did he die the day of Passover, or did he die on the day of preparation for the Passover? In other words, the day before Passover. Well, it depends on whether you want to follow what Mark says or what John says. They both date the death of Jesus precisely, and they give different dates. So there are differences that appear to be irreconcilable. Of course, you can take everything that Jesus says on the cross in Mark, and everything he says in Luke, and everything he says in Matthew, and everything he says in John, and combine them together into one big story so that he says all of these things. But if you do that, you need to realize that what you're doing is creating your own gospel, which is unlike any of the four Gospels of the New Testament. And so if he said all of these things, the seven last words of the dying Jesus, that's a different understanding from the understanding portrayed in Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. And I just think that when you read Mark, you ought to see what Mark has to say, not pretend he's saying the same thing that Luke has to say, etc.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email us. That goes to think@kera.org. Let's go next to Thomas in Dallas. Hello, Thomas.
Hi. Yeah, I had considered seminary and was discouraged by the difference between, like, say, what scholars believe and what's discussed in church. It just didn't see much hope in it. It seems to me that the Unitarian Jesus, it is about the only way to reconcile the Old and New Testaments. I mean, otherwise you have, you know, Jesus advocating he's God, which would be blasphemy to the people he's talking to, and so the Jews would have killed him, and according to their law.
Let me stop you for a second, Thomas. When you say the Unitarian Jesus, do you mean Jesus as presented by the Unitarian Church?
Non-Trinitarian. Jesus was the man. And I've read your book. Some of the gospel writers were advocating the different views in there. But again, to reconcile with the Old Testament, the Jews weren't waiting for a Messiah to worship as God and these things. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. So as it turns out, the Gospel of John, our last gospel, is the only gospel in which Jesus is explicitly identified as being himself divine. He of course, he's the Son of God in all of the gospels, but what most readers don't realize is that in ancient Judaism, the Son of God was not thought to be God. The Son of God was a human. Who was chosen by God to fulfill his purposes on earth. So, for example, in the Old Testament, Solomon is called the Son of God in 2 Samuel chapter 7, or the nation of Israel is called the Son of God in Hosea chapter 11. So the Son of God was a human, and in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus is completely human. He's the Messiah. Again, the Messiah was not understood to be a divine figure, but a human figure. It's only when you get to the Gospel of John that Jesus is portrayed as himself being, in some sense, God. And so, John is almost certainly the last of our Gospels to be written. And so what scholars have long argued and believed is that John is representing a later theological understanding of Jesus that doesn't conform to the historical Jesus himself, but conforms to a later theological religious understanding of him.
What can we know for certain, independent of the Bible itself, about Jesus, the person who walked physically on the earth?
You know, one of the interesting things is that people assume that there must be a lot of records about Jesus outside of the Bible. I mean, if he's the miracle-working Son of God who's healing the sick and casting out demons and raising the dead, everybody must be talking about him in the Roman Empire. As it turns out, so far as we can tell from our records, people were not talking about him. We have no single reference to Jesus in a Roman or a Greek source in the first century. So for 70 years after his death, there's not a single reference to him. His name doesn't even occur in any record, except for one Jewish historian, Josephus, who mentions him twice in his many volumes of writings. So it's not until the second century that you start getting Romans mentioning Jesus, which, I think it's certain that Jesus existed, and we can say some things about him, but he's not talked about in non-Christian, non-canonical sources.
How did the things that were written as scripture in the New Testament start to change as the early Christian church moved into its own as a church, as opposed to being a sect of Judaism?
That's a great question, because scholars have long recognized that Jesus himself was thoroughly Jewish. He was born Jewish. He was raised Jewish. He kept Jewish culture. He kept Jewish customs. He kept the Jewish law, became a Jewish rabbi, gathered Jewish followers. I mean, he was thoroughly Jewish. Yet within about 100 years after Jesus' death, the Christian church itself is primarily non-Jewish, doesn't keep the Jewish law, and in fact is anti-Jewish. It opposes non-Christian Jews, and as time goes on, the animosity increases, so that in the late 2nd century into the 3rd century, Christians teach that being Jewish is to be opposed to God, so that Christianity moved from being a sect within Judaism, started by Jesus, to being an anti-Jewish religion within 100, 150 years, and that's one of the most interesting aspects of the history of early Christianity.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Bart Ehrman is my guest. His new book is called Jesus Interrupted, Revealing the Hidden Contradictions in the Bible and Why We Don't Know About Them. Let's go next to Tamara in Rowlett. Hi, Tamara.
Hello. Thank you for having me on your show.
Sure.
I'm going back to the beginning of the show, if you don't mind, to where the author, Mr. Ehrman, talked about the Passover and there being some sort of discrepancy regarding the date mentioned in Mark versus the date, and please help me here, Mr. Ehrman, the date mentioned, and was it...
And John, yes.
Or John?
Yes.
Well, I would just like to comment, and I'm going to take you back to the Old Testament, if you don't mind, and I'm going to take you back to Numbers 28. Please bear with me. Let's turn here, Numbers 28, 16, where it says, "And the 14th day of the first month is the Passover of the Lord, and the 15th day of the month is the feast." Both Passover season, and I am a Passover keeper, both Passover season and Days of Unleavened Bread are spoken of synonymously as seasons. However, Passover is but the day of preparation. So while most of the Jews were busy preparing their lambs for sacrifice, the disciples were having dinner with Christ, the Last Supper, as we refer to it. They were having the Last Supper with Christ, who was the Passover lamb. Now, they kept the feast, as Israel always did. They kept the feast the day following Passover. Passover is not a feast day. The feast day is the day following the day of preparation, which is Passover. When Jesus instituted the Lord's Supper, that was the first time.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I think we know
anything was done on Passover day. So we need to correct that and read scriptures carefully.
Tamara, I think I appreciate your call very much. And I do think we have your point. It's something that comes up in the book. So Bart, maybe you can speak about this. And if you get interrupted, we'll finish after the break.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Yeah, no, it's an interesting point. I mean, my point is that if when you read Mark's gospel, they eat the Passover meal. And after they eat the Passover meal, Jesus gets arrested, spends the night in jail, and is crucified the next morning at 9 o'clock in the morning, according to Mark 15:25. In the Gospel of John, Jesus is not said to eat a Passover meal, and when he's crucified, sometime after noon, we're told that it was the day before the Passover, the day of preparation for the Passover, so that Jesus in Mark's Gospel gets killed the day after the meal is eaten, and in John's Gospel, he gets killed the day before the meal is eaten. And so I think that probably is a discrepancy.
Bart Ehrman is with us. He is James A. Gray, Distinguished Professor of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. His new book is called Jesus Interrupted, Revealing the Hidden Contradictions in the Bible and Why We Don't Know About Them. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Bart Ehrman. He is James A. Gray, Distinguished Professor of Religious Studies at UNC Chapel Hill. His new book is called Jesus Interrupted, Revealing the Hidden Contradictions in the Bible and Why We Don't Know About Them. I want to go back for a minute, Bart, because, you know, there's been some argument about the dates that certain things happened and discrepancies, which certainly bear looking at. Now, many people will say, regardless of whether the date is right or wrong here, the real message of both of those Gospels really focuses on the fact that Jesus was, in fact, crucified. Is that the approach that most of your colleagues who have studied the Bible very carefully and see these discrepancies ultimately take if they remain steadfast in their Christian faiths?
Well, I mean, it's absolutely true. I mean, that all of the Gospels want to stress that Jesus was crucified and was raised from the dead. And so there's no dispute that that's what each of the Gospels of the New Testament is saying. So some people wonder, you know, why does it matter if he gets executed the day before the Passover meal was eaten or the day after it was eaten? I mean, why worry about little details? And the way I explain it to my students is the analogy is that that there's been a murder that's taken place and a detective is called in, and the detective starts hunting around the room where the murder victim is, looking for fingerprints and for a strand of hair. And somebody could reasonably say, what are you doing looking for little pieces of hair? I mean, there's a dead body on the floor. But the thing is, to solve the crime, you have to look for little pieces of evidence. And that's how it is with ancient literature. Sometimes it's the little details that tell you what you need to know about a text. And when you look at the little details and see that they are different, you start realizing that, in fact, there are big things that are different between these texts, that these texts have different points of view, not just slight little discrepancies, but very different understandings of what is trying to be conveyed in these texts. And it's those differences that can't be just sort of covered over. If you pretend the differences don't exist, then you're probably not listening to what each author himself is trying to say.
Let's hear next from Jennifer in Dallas. Hi, Jennifer.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I made an emotional call based on the response on the comment that the young woman said about canceling your show because of the points of view that you give us to think about. And I just want to express that I think it's, your show is very important that you give us points of view on a variety of subjects that may not be that may be challenging to some of the other citizens in the area. And
well, I appreciate that. Thank you.
I think that introspection on all subjects, including the religious background that many of us have been raised with, is worthy, and that with exploration and looking into another point of view, you can either deepen your faith or broaden your perspective about others in the world. And I just want you to continue forward. And while I don't have a specific question for the author, I appreciate his points of view and broadening the scope of the religious discussion in the area. So thanks so much.
Thanks for your call. I wonder, Bart, if you're ever surprised, if you think at this point that you can sort of tell by meeting people briefly how they'll respond to your ideas about things like this, and then if people take you by surprise.
I rarely get taken by surprise because there's a certain number of reactions that one would expect, and we're hearing many of them on your show today. There's some people who are outraged, and there's some people who are open-minded, and there's a lot of reactions in between.
Maybe you can talk for a minute about the fact that although this is a document that you are very fond of, that you no longer view the Bible as a sacred thing, can you talk about why you continue to study it and sort of devote your academic and professional life to the Bible specifically?
Yeah, that's a good question, because a lot of people wonder, you know, if I don't believe in the Bible, why do I do my research on it? Why do I teach it? But I have to say, as a university professor, that view has always struck me as a little bit strange, because I have friends who teach in the philosophy department, and they teach about Plato, but they're not Platonists themselves. And I have friends who teach in the political science department, and they teach about Marxism, but they're not communists. They think Marxism is important to understand. And I know people who teach Chaucer in the English department, but they don't believe in Chaucer. They understand that Chaucer is important literature. Well, there's nothing more important than the Bible. I mean, in terms of a book, it's the most important book in the history of civilization. So, of course, I'm interested in it. And so I try to study it as a historian, because I think it's just terrifically important for understanding our form of culture and civilization.
Let's go next to Fort Worth and speak with Nikki. Hello, Nikki.
Hi. I just had a question on which version of the Bible you were talking about, because I know there's different kinds.
Ah, good question. When I make claims about the New Testament one way or the other, I'm actually basing those on the Greek New Testament itself, the New Testament in the original Greek language, which scholars, of course, of the New Testament have to learn Greek, and they have to learn Hebrew and other ancient languages to be able to read these ancient texts. A related question is what English translation do I recommend? And I think there are a lot of very good English translations available. The one that I have my students read is the New Revised Standard Version, which is an English translation that I think is very readable, and it's one of the most accurate, probably the most accurate translation that's available, in my opinion.
How were decisions made in the early church about what would actually be included in the canon and what would not, given that there were a number of gospels and accounts of the life of Jesus that didn't make it into what we now think of as the Christian New Testament?
Yeah, that's another great question, because people just think of the New Testament as something that was given from the very beginning, that, you know, maybe a few weeks after Jesus died or something, the New Testament came into existence. But we know from the writings of the church fathers that there were enormous debates for decades over centuries, over which books ought to be included. You know, should the book of Revelation be in the New Testament? Should the Gospel of Peter be in the New Testament? Should the Epistle of Barnabas be in the New Testament? These debates went on for a long time. It wasn't until the end of the fourth Christian century that we have any Christian at all who lists our 27 books as being the New Testament. So that's 300 years after these books were written is the first time anybody stated that our 27 books were to be in. So the church fathers who made these decisions wanted to include books that they thought were ancient, near the time of Jesus. They wanted books that claimed to be written by apostles, and they wanted books that were widely read throughout the Christian church. Most importantly, they wanted books that portrayed what they understood to be the orthodox faith, meaning the right understanding of the religion, so that if a gospel or an epistle had a different point of view, they didn't want to include that because they were sure that an apostle could not have written it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Allison in Dallas. Hey, Allison.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good. I wanted to comment. I also wanted to commend the author. I remember what he said about faith scholarship being oil and water. For me personally, I have found scholarship to be the bane of my faith. With a Christian worldview, the more knowledge you get, I believe, the more stronger your faith is, as your faith, for me at least, is a knowledgeable trust in that of God. At the same time, I do experience the oil and water mixture in different, like, different theology classes. I've actually found the Bible to be a struggle within my faith. Learning of the different canonical meetings, the discrepancies, it is a little hard sometimes. At the same time, though, I find it a little silly that there's been people calling with kind of more of a blind anger, a defensive side. I definitely see why they would be. It's easy to initially hear this and read this and think it blasphemous or something. But what they need to remember, and I think he touched on this earlier, is that these are perspectives of different people, humans, with different occupations, personalities. I wanted to ask him, however, how he managed in his studies, his historical studies, not to create his own gospel, his own version, as we all seem to have an easy tendency to do that.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, I think one of the things that historians who approach the New Testament do is they try to let each of the Gospels of the New Testament convey its own message, instead of imposing their message on the Gospel and pretending that one Gospel says exactly what some other Gospel is saying. And it's hard to do. It's hard to read without injecting your own views on the text. But I think people who learn how to do that end up changing their views. And I think this is a good piece of evidence that there are some readers who don't impose their own views on the text, because when they read the text carefully and let the text speak, they change their views about the text. So my views of the text changed drastically over the years as I learned how to read the Bible historically rather than reading it as if all these authors were basically saying the same thing, which was, of course, the same thing was the view that I had. So learning that in fact, authors of the New Testament might disagree with me was a major step toward letting them speak for themselves.
Do you have a sense that the people who wrote what became the New Testament understood that they were writing what would be the Bible?
I think the answer is absolutely not. I think that every one of them would have been shocked to think that their books would be combined with other books and made into the Bible. For them, the Bible was the Hebrew Bible, what we call the Old Testament. So that, just to take an example, when Paul was writing his letters to the churches that we have, he was writing letters. And he didn't think he was writing the Bible. He thought he was writing a letter to his followers in Corinth or to those in Thessalonica. And so the way I put it to my students is that when they read these letters of Paul, they need to realize they're reading somebody else's mail.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll take one final call from Frank in DeSoto. Hi, Frank.
Oh, hi, Ari. Hi. Our theological reading group in our Dallas church, UC Central UCC, has read some of his earlier books. We think it's great, and I've seen him on History Channel. What I wanted to ask was, earlier on, you mentioned why ministers don't want to raise some of these questions, and I just wanted to refer him to a wonderful book that I know it's used in Hartford Theological and others called The Disadvantaged Church by Jack Good. It points out that ministers are often afraid that those of us who are in the pews out there just don't really want to. We're afraid of the questions. We're afraid of the questions because we think somehow it will ruin our faith or make us uncomfortable. We seem to forget that Jesus came not just to comfort the afflicted, but to afflict the comfortable. And those of us in the pews who are comfortable don't want our ministers raising questions or making us feel in any way afflicted.
Thanks for your call. What do you think about that, Bart?
I think it's a great point, and I think that it's absolutely right that there are a lot of ministers who don't want to make their people feel uncomfortable, and I can completely understand that, but it's also important that people have an educated faith. And so even for those who remain in the Christian tradition, it's much better to be knowledgeable about that tradition than it is to be ignorant of it, and even if that makes you uncomfortable. And I don't think pastors should worry so much that people are going to lose their faith if they acquire historical knowledge. It's simply going to make them more knowledgeable. It might change their faith, but that might be a good thing.
How does it work around the Thanksgiving dinner table of your extended family, Bart? Is religion one of those things that you have to avoid talking about?
Well, it depends which part of my family you mean. So the family I was raised in, my mother is a very strong evangelical Christian, and she and I don't see eye to eye on religious matters, and so we tend to talk about NCAA basketball.
Also a tough topic if you're from North Carolina.
Pardon me?
Sometimes also
a
tough topic.
Yeah, no, it's a great topic. And so I was raised in Lawrence, Kansas, where the Kansas Jayhawks are. Mm-hmm. And so we have a lot of rivalry to talk about without even going down the religion route.
the last thing I want to ask you about is that you write that your principal goal is to force people to really think about the Bible. Do you think that religions inadvertently discourage this, or are people who are religious understanding incorrectly what they're expected to do?
I think some aspects of religion, some areas of religion do discourage thinking. I think here in the American South, there are churches where people are told they can't doubt, they can't question, they can't think. And I think that my own view is that if God exists, God gave people minds, and he expects them to use their minds. People have brains, and they have to use their brains, and that one shouldn't hide one's head in the sand like an ostrich and pretend that there are not things to learn. In fact, by questioning
I'm so
faith,
sorry that we're out of time. Bart Ehrman's latest book is called Jesus Interrupted. Bart, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.